Great. Okay, well, we're going to get started here with our Polar Connect event from Tulik Field Station up in northern Alaska. These folks will tell us more about exactly where they are. But we have Bruce Tatterka and Nell Kemp, who have been up at Tulik Field Station working on separate research projects that they were doing a Polar Connect event together. So some of their research team is available on this event as well. We might be hearing from them. Today's Tuesday, July 16th, and it's 11 o'clock here in Alaska. So thanks for joining us from wherever you might be. As we're getting started, you should be able to see slides moving on your computer if you're connected online. So this is a system called Blackboard Collaborate. So slides should be kind of the main thing that you're seeing. There's a list of participants over on the left, a chat box on the bottom left where you can be talking to one another and certainly add questions if you have them for Bruce and Nell. And there is video feed from Tulik Field Station. If you can see it, it would be the left top corner of your screen. And there might be some delay with video and audio. You can see Bruce waving there now. If it does kind of get a little distracting, you're welcome to close that panel so that you can listen rather than have that delay. All right, well, and also if you want to participate, you can raise your hand over on the left to ask a question, and we'll certainly leave questions, time for questions at the end. If you're connected by phone, just make sure that you mute your phone by pressing star 6 or using the mute button. All right, and now while we're getting started, all the participants that are here, if you could tell us who you are, what school or institution you might be associated with, and if you have anybody else joining you from wherever you are, if you've got students with you, that would be great to know. And to let you know a little bit about how Nell and Bruce made it up to Tulik Field Station, they're part of the Polar Trek program, which is teachers and researchers exploring and collaborating. It's a professional development experience for K-12 educators to head out to the Arctic or Antarctic to do hands-on field research with a team and bringing that science and experience back into their classrooms. They're out there for 2 to 6 weeks in these projects, and we've had nearly 50 teachers from around the United States in this particular grant, and we've been going on for a couple of years now, so there's lots of information available about past and current expeditions that are available on the website. So that's a little bit about Polar Trek. Again, while we're going through our presentation, if you've got questions, you're welcome to type them in the chat box. And it looks like Nell and Bruce will be able to tag team questions while they're presenting. And at the end, you'll be able to raise your hand and ask questions live. And when you're doing that, you want to press the talk button down to speak, and then press it again when you're done. And that button is right above the participant list on the left. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bruce that will start talking about his expedition, Arctic Sunlight and Microbial Interactions. Bruce, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Sarah. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Okay. So I'm here at the Tulik Field Station. I've been here about 3 weeks now, and I'll talk a little bit about my expedition, then turn it over to Nell and let her talk about hers. So if you've been following us online, this is my expedition webpage, and you can see me there. I've been keeping my journals up there, and there's also some information about the researchers, principal investigators I'm working with, Rose Corey, who's with us online from Michigan, and George Kling, who's also professor at Michigan. You might hear some helicopter sounds in the background. People are busy today, but that's what that mechanical noise you hear is. Here's Nell's expedition page, and she'll be talking about spiders in the food web after I do my thing here. So this is where we are right now at the Tulik Field Station. It's in the foothills of the Brooks Range on the north slope of Alaska, right off the Dalton Highway. We're a little over 100 miles from the Arctic Ocean. We have beautiful views of the mountains to the south. And this is a picture of Tulik right there. It's a real nice field camp. on the shore of Tulik Lake right off the highway, and there's all kinds of different expeditions going on here. So what I want to do today is mainly talk about three things. The first thing is going to be what permafrost is and why it's important to the Earth's carbon cycle and global climate change. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about what Dr. Corey and Dr. Kling's team is doing up here to study permafrost and the carbon cycle. And then I'll wrap it up by trying to show some of the big picture findings that Rose and George and their team have come up with. So this is a map on the right here showing where the Earth's permafrost is in purple. And it's not a map that you're used to looking at, probably. It's centered on the North Pole. And you can see in purple here, there's a lot of permafrost in Russia, Alaska, and in Canada. And what permafrost is permanently frozen ground. And this is a picture of some permafrost here on the left. And what it is a mixture of frozen soil, lots and lots of organic remains, mostly plants, and ice. So there's a huge amount of permafrost in the Earth, and it's important to the Earth's carbon cycle. So let's just take a minute to talk about the Earth's carbon cycle. This is a picture of the tundra right outside of Tulik, looking south at the Brooks Range. And if you want to know where the carbon is in the Earth's carbon cycle, the first place it is in the air in the form of carbon dioxide. That carbon gets taken in to the plants through photosynthesis, and it becomes organic matter. You'll get a lot of carbon in organic matter through photosynthesis. And then once the organic matter is there, that gets broken down by microbes and gets eaten by animals who break the organic matter down, they eat it, and they undergo the process of respiration, and that puts the carbon back in the atmosphere. That's the very basics of the carbon cycle here on the tundra. And now why the carbon cycle and permafrost are important is because over the years, there's been a lot more carbon taken into the plants through photosynthesis. And in fact, the organic matter has built up in the tundra over the past few thousand years to the point where there's 1,600 billion tons of carbon stored in organic matter in the Earth's permafrost. Now, this is important to climate change because if that carbon and locked up in organic matter and permafrost becomes carbon dioxide, or if some of it becomes carbon dioxide, it'll go up into the Earth's atmosphere and promote global warming. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. So in the big picture, hopefully the helicopters aren't too loud here in the background, folks. In the big picture, this map shows temperature increases on Earth over the past 100 years or so, and what you can see is the most intense global warming effects are seen in the Arctic, the dark orange colors. So what we're concerned about is as global warming takes place, that permafrost is going to start to thaw, and all of that stored up carbon could potentially be converted to greenhouse gases and promote climate change. So the big question is, what's going to happen to that 1,600 billion tons of carbon as the permafrost warms and starts to thaw? And this is what Dr. Corey and Dr. Kling and their team are focusing on in a very, very detailed and comprehensive way. And it's really been fascinating for me over the past 3 weeks to see the type of work they're doing. So I've got some pictures here just to give you a sense of how they're learning about what's going on with permafrost carbon. So the question is, what happens to carbon? This is a stream valley near here called the Naviat Creek, and the flow of carbon from the thawing permafrost to wherever it ends up starts with these features called water tracks. And they're kind of like streams, but there's really no flowing water. The water's flowing right below the surface, and what that does, you can see there's a different kind of vegetation here along the water track. But the water is flowing just below the surface, and that water contains carbon from broken down organic matter. And here's a picture of Katie, one of the research assistants in Rose's lab, actually collecting samples of water from a water track. She's got a soil needle stuck into the ground here, and she's using a syringe to suck water out of the water track. And then we'll take that back into the lab and run lots of tests on it to figure out what kind of carbon is in the water in that soil track and where it's going and what the likelihood is of that carbon being converted to carbon dioxide. So it starts with the water tracks, and then we go into the ponds and wetlands where the water tracks flow into and take samples from those, again, to find out what's going on with the carbon in there. Here's a picture of me collecting samples of gas. This little box is floating on top of a pond along a Naviat Creek, and I'm collecting gas samples there. So we can measure what kind of greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide are actually coming off the waters from the thawing tundra. Those little creeks flow into lakes and rivers. And here's George Kling last week, or 2 weeks ago, actually sampling one of the headwaters of one of the major rivers flowing from the Brooks Range to the ocean, again, to take carbon samples and see what's going on with the carbon in the rivers. We go and we sample lakes up in the headwaters, the foothills of the Brooks Range. Here's a picture of some of the researchers carrying around rubber rafts to go paddle out into these lakes with snow still on them, taking water samples from the lakes. And you can see here, we're up in the foothills, the ground is kind of hilly here. But we also went down to the coastal plain right near the Arctic Ocean, where the landscape is perfectly flat and the lakes have a different character there, but we took samples of that water too and tested it for carbon. So the point I'm trying to get across here is that the team is out sampling all over the tundra, trying to understand what the carbon is doing in the different parts of the landscape so we can figure how the carbon from thawing permafrost is being converted to carbon dioxide, or maybe being buried in the sediment at the bottom of lakes, or maybe carried out to the Arctic Ocean. Two other things the team is doing is studying microbes, the bacteria that actually break down the organic matter and convert it to carbon dioxide. So here's a picture of me and Michelle and hordes of mosquitoes out on the tundra as we're collecting samples of water and filtering it so we can collect the microbes that are in there. And then those get taken back to the lab, and we actually test those, the DNA in those samples to understand what kind of bacteria are in there. And here's another experiment we're doing. We're actually feeding organic matter to the bacteria to see how fast they grow and how fast they produce carbon dioxide. So a big part of the work here is to study the microbes and understand how they're converting carbon dioxide to CO2. And there's Michelle in the lab preparing those samples for DNA analysis. And another important part of the work is to understand the effect of sunlight in converting organic matter into carbon dioxide. And one of the reasons this is important is because as the permafrost thaws, it's collapsing. This is called a thermokarst feature. It's like a big landslide. And what that does is exposes permafrost that was frozen maybe for thousands of years. Suddenly it's exposed to sunlight. And sunlight has an important effect in breaking down the organic matter and converting it to carbon dioxide, or making it easier for the bacteria to convert it to carbon dioxide. So that's another big part of the work up here, is seeing how these thermokarst features are affecting the carbon cycle. And that's going to get more important as the permafrost continues to thaw. Here's a picture of me doing some testing on the sunlight. This is basically a light meter, and I'm lowering it down in the water column of this river to see how much light is penetrating beneath the surface and what the effect of that light might be on the carbon that's being carried down the river. So that's how the team is studying carbon. And then I just have two more slides here to kind of bring it together and show you the big picture. This is a diagram by Dr. Kling, and it basically shows what I've been showing in those pictures. We've got carbon and organic matter in the land here, and these arrows show that carbon flowing across the landscape into the groundwater and into rivers and lakes. And some of that material gets buried in the lake, some gets carried down to the ocean, but some gets converted to carbon dioxide and methane, which is another heat-trapping gas that causes global warming. And the findings that the team is seeing now are real interesting. What we see is on land, carbon is actually being taken in from the atmosphere and stored in organic matter. So carbon is still building up on land, as it has been doing for thousands of years. However, in the water bodies, carbon is actually being emitted from the water to the atmosphere. And you can see with these numbers here, depending on how much carbon is being stored in land and exactly how much carbon is being emitted from the water to the atmosphere, it may be that carbon is building up in total on the tundra landscape. It may be that the land and the water balance each other out and we're not increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Or it may be that the fresh water is having more of an impact releasing carbon than is building up on land, which means that the tundra is actually contributing to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now. And how this is working right now is exactly not known, but it's an important thing the team is working on to try to figure out where that carbon balance is now, and especially in the future, as permafrost warms even more. And then last slide here, the big picture. I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but if you're interested, you can go to my online blog, and I put this diagram up there and talked about it in one of the recent postings I had. But you can see this big circle represents carbon on land. And you can see from the air, carbon is flowing to the land through photosynthesis. But from the land, carbon is flowing to lakes in groundwater and through rivers. Some of that carbon in the lakes is going out to the atmosphere, some is flowing out to the ocean, and some is getting buried. So a big challenge is how these numbers actually work and where the carbon is going. But you can see that lakes are a key player. Carbon flows into lakes, and from there, it can either get buried, it can go to the ocean, or it can go to the air, which is what we're really concerned about. And then the last thing to notice here is that with all the coal and petroleum and oil and gas that we burn, there's huge amounts of carbon dioxide going from the land to the air. So until we get this under control, this is not going to be a major player, but hopefully one of these days we'll get the fossil fuel under control, and then we'll need to understand what's going on with the carbon flowing from land. So that's a basic overview of what the team here is doing to study carbon from thawing permafrost, and here is my rainbow to end my part of the talk, and then I'm going to hand it over to Nell now.
Perfect. Thanks, everybody. Nell, before you get going, I just wanted to give a chance to George or Rose to be able to, if you want to take the microphone and be able to talk a little bit more about some of those answers you were giving in the chat box about carbon and the release becoming methane or carbon dioxide, or a little more about the thermal karst action that you're seeing there or elsewhere. I'll just kind of leave the mic open here for a second.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
This is George Klang at the University of Michigan. I'll talk a little bit about the thermal karst failures, and then maybe Rose can talk a little bit about the about how this organic carbon, that stuff that you see all there in the picture with the rainbow, gets turned into CO2 or methane. Or if there are other questions, please anybody just jump in or type something. The permafrost is around Tulik Lake here, starts about 1 meter below the surface, sometimes even shallower than that, sometimes just 30 centimeters below the surface of the land. The soil is frozen, and it extends down about 200 meters. On the coastal plain up by the Arctic Ocean, it can go down 600 meters of frozen ground. So that's one of the questions here, how thick is the permafrost? And what happens is that many of these permafrost soils have a lot of water in them that's frozen into ice. And if the soil warms enough so that the ice melts, it essentially drains away, and now there are all these hollows in the soil. And the weight of the soil collapses on itself. And what happens is if there's enough water at the bottom of this collapse zone, kind of like having a lubricating surface at the bottom of an avalanche, the soil just forms a landslide and disrupts the ground and mixes up this very old, thousands of years old, carbon stored in permafrost up to the surface. There was a question about whether these thermokarst failures have increased. We don't really know that yet for the tundra. We don't have good aerial photography from, say, 50 years ago where we could compare that to now. We know that these kinds of failures, like the one that's on the screen right now, have been occurring for a very long period of time. They're a natural part of the Arctic landscape. One of the questions is whether they're increasing because of global warming, and we just don't know that yet.
Thanks, George, for that. And I'll leave the mic open here for Rose if you want to comment. All right. Thanks so much for checking in. That's great. And is there anybody else who does have a question on what Bruce was mentioning or Dr. Kling? And you're welcome to raise your hand and let us know. You're welcome to ask that question live, and then we'll go over to Nell and talk to her about her project.
Okay.
And we will have time at the end, we hope, for questions if something comes up, and keep asking them in the chat box as well. So I will turn it over to Nell.
Okay, can you hear me? Yep. Okay. Hi, I'm Nell Kemp, and I am here working with Amanda Colt, who is at Duke University. And so I'm actually going to build upon Bruce's presentation, because basically he gave you a really good overview of permafrost and sort of the flow of carbon through the tundra. And so what Amanda is doing is sort of looking at the biotic factors that are also helping to impact decomposition rates here in the permafrost soil. And she is also working with two research assistants, Kiki and Sarah, who are not here, but they are here in spirit. And so this is just a picture. I don't have a picture of Sarah, unfortunately, but there's Kiki and Amanda. This is on a hike when we first got here. So as Bruce said, we're up here in Chulik Field Station, so this is just kind of a different picture showing you some of the Arctic research stations around the world, and Chulik is sort of the major field station in the Alaskan Arctic Circle. There is another one in Barrow, but Chulik is much bigger than the one in Barrow. There's actually another Polar Track teacher at Barrow right now. I think Hollis, is that right? Is that his name? Hollis is there. But Bruce and I are here at Chulik. We had another teacher who left us right before we got here, but Chulik's a great place. So I encourage anyone who has the opportunity to come here. This is an overview of Chulik, an aerial image, so you can kind of see in the left that's Chulik Lake, and in the right is our trailer park where everyone lives and all the labs are. And then that orange circle is where our spider plots are located. We have 30 plots up in the tundra. So all those little circles there that you see, each one of those is a plot. And if you're wondering what sort of these long white lines are, that's the tundra boardwalk. Tundra is very hard to walk through. Sort of imagine like if you are marching like a soldier, that's kind of how you have to walk through the tundra, because there are these, first of all, it's really marshy and really soggy, but then there are these giant grass, like, I don't know, footstools, you want to call them, called tussocks. So you have to walk in between them. So there are, I think, something like 8 miles of boardwalk, and they're just wooden platforms that you walk across just to make your life a little bit easier. So what are we studying here? We are studying the wolf spider, and there are 13 to 15 species of wolf spider here at Chulik. it's very hard to identify them just by eyeballing them. You have to use a really high-powered microscope, and you also have to know a lot about spiders. So I personally cannot identify the different species, but Amanda and Kiki can. And so if you look in the upper left-hand corner, that's just a little spider on a piece of snow. And if you look in the bottom left-hand corner, that's just kind of to give you an idea of the size of the wolf spider. That's the blade of an X-Acto knife. So the spiders are pretty small. I think the biggest one I've seen is maybe the size of a penny. And then the upper right-hand corner, that is a female wolf spider carrying her egg sac. The females carry their babies in this little egg sac, and after about 2 weeks they hatch, and the spiderlings hop on the mother's back, and they live there for, I think, a couple days. And then in the lower right-hand corner, those are little vials. Each one has a spider, a dead spider inside. They're going to be analyzed to figure out the spider's role in the food web by determining how much of isotopes of nitrogen they have. Okay, so why do we study spiders? So this is sort of a general food web of the Arctic tundra. And if you'll notice, you know, the wolf itself is the top predator. And so most people think that, you know, we should be studying wolves because they're eating everything here in the tundra. But I can tell you that I've been here for about 3 weeks and I have seen zero wolves. But I've seen probably hundreds and hundreds of wolf spider. So the wolf spider plays a really important role in this food web because it eats all of the insects and all of the detritivores that are living in the tundra soil. And as Bruce already explained, all these little microbes and these little insects are helping to break down all that dead and decaying plant matter that's in the soil. So if the wolf spider is eating those detritivores and all of those decomposers, obviously they're playing a really big role in influencing the amount of carbon that's released from that permafrost soil. So here's just kind of a picture of all these little guys that the spider's eating. The spiders are generalist predators, so they'll pretty much eat anything that you put in front of them that's the right size and that looks attractive to them. In our class alone, we see hundreds of spiders. So there's so many of them out there eating all of these little decomposers. So they're playing a pretty big role. So this is just a picture of where these organisms live. This is Amanda. She's actually slicing into the tundra. And I'll talk about what she's going to do with the soil in a minute. But basically, in that little section of soil, there could be hundreds of microorganisms living there and hundreds of these tiny little insects. Okay? So again, just to recap, if you think about what Bruce was saying before about the permafrost and all the decomposition that's happening there, all of that stored carbon, that plant litter that's basically been frozen for thousands of years and hasn't been allowed to decompose, you've got these organisms, bacteria and fungi, and these tiny little microinvertebrates like mites and springtails and all these things. They're basically helping to break down all that decomposition, that decomposing plant litter. Then you have the wolf spider that's preying upon them. So if you think about where the role of the wolf spider, you know, it really has an indirect relationship with this decomposition in the permafrost soil. Just did something here, sorry. Okay. And another interesting thing that's been found in some studies in Greenland is that global climate change is increasing the size of some of these wolf spiders. Their body size is actually increasing, and potentially the amount of wolf spiders is increasing as well. So you may have more of these wolf spiders, which are bigger, which means they're going to eat more of these little invertebrates. So again, just think about sort of the impact that could have on that decomposition rate. So why the Arctic? Bruce already covered this. You know, the Arctic is warming faster than any other place on the planet. And so again, we've got these spiders that are potentially getting bigger. They are a major predator in this ecosystem. They're eating these decomposers, and the temperatures are changing. More of this permafrost is thawing. More of this plant litter is now available for decomposition. So then you have this top predator, which is indirectly influencing the rate of decomposition by the amount of organism it eats. So how do we study them? So these are some pictures of what our plots look like. So if you look in the left, upper left corner, that is just an example of a typical plot. We have 30 of these little plots. They've been here for about 3 years, and we check them every summer, or Amanda checks them every summer. So you have two types of plots. You have what's called a low-density spider plot and a high-density spider plot. And as you can imagine, they're just really the amount of spiders that are in those plots. And then each of these plots receives a different warming treatment. So if you look in the middle picture, you can see that they are covered. All these plots are covered. And they either receive just sort of, it's like a fibrous sheet, which allows, have holes in the top and allows for gas exchange and heat exchange, and sunlight still penetrates. Or they receive a plastic sheet on top, which acts kind of like a little greenhouse and warms that little section of the tundra. And if you look in the right-hand corner, that's just a control plot. So it has no cover, and it has no metal fencing around it. So it's just sort of normal section of the tundra. But we still take a soil sample from that and sort of look for spiders there. So you basically have two things going on. You have different amounts of spiders in these plots and different warming treatments. So at the end of the summer, we just actually did this last Saturday, Amanda will take a soil sample from each of these plots. And you can see she's measuring the size of the plot, and I'm recording how big the sample was. She's actually going to separate it into the surface green layer and the brown below ground layer. And then we take those soil samples back to the lab, and you put them, you weigh them. Of course, weighing is very accurate. And you put them in something called a Burley's funnel. So basically what you do is you take the soil samples, you put them through cheesecloth, and you put them in a funnel with mesh, and then you apply a heat source over to it. A lamp heats the soil, and all of these little organisms that are in the soil do not like the warmth. So what they do is they sort of crawl down this funnel, and you can see there's a cup underneath which contains ethanol. So they get trapped in the ethanol and unfortunately die. And then in this whole process, depending on how much soil there is, can take up to a week. To thoroughly heat that soil and get those organisms out of there. So she'll have 60 different samples of soil because she has 30 plots, and then each sample gets, or each plot gets a soil sample, but then it's cut in half for the above ground layer and the below ground layer. And then if you look in the bottom, you can see we've got Sarah and Amanda and Kiki all working in microscopes. And what they're doing is they're analyzing that cup of ethanol to see what organisms are living there. And there can be hundreds of organisms living in that one little sample of soil. So she's going to analyze the number of organisms there are, the types of organisms there are, and then she's going to correlate those with, you know, the plot that she took it from. So basically, if you have a high spider plot which has a warming treatment, what kind of organisms are living in that soil? Are the spiders influencing what the organisms are doing living in that soil? Then if you look at the bottom picture and sort of the second right, you can see that there are these black bags. And those black bags contain decomposing plant material, leaf litter. And so one of the other things she's going to compare her these organisms and the number of spiders and all of this data with is the decomposition rate of these leaves. So she has these litter bags inside and outside the pot, and they've been there for a while. And so she wants to see if the rate of decomposition is being affected by the spiders that are in these pots in the warming treatment. So is the decomposition occurring at a faster rate or a slower rate? And another thing that she also puts into her data set, if you look in the right-hand picture, there's a little thing called an eye button, which basically records the temperature, I think, every 20 minutes. So she looks at what the temperature is like in these plots, and again, that becomes another variable in her data set. So she has a lot of data to analyze. So one of the things that people don't realize about field biologists is that they actually spend a significant amount of time in the lab analyzing data. So while it's really fun, while she's here at Tulik, you know, she's 3 months here and she's out in the field and it's wonderful, the rest of the year, the 9 months that she's in North Carolina, she's stuck in a lab looking through all of these samples, counting and recording all of this information, and then basically parsing all this data and putting it together and analyzing it and trying to come up with something. But she has figured out something that's really interesting while she's here. So she's been here for about 3 years, and like a typical scientist, she noticed something and decided to investigate a side project that she thought was pretty interesting. So one thing she noticed is she was looking at the egg sacs that the mothers carry on their back. And she noticed that some of these egg sacs, when she opened them up, had these parasitoid wasps in them. So these wasps are coming in and laying their eggs in the spider's egg sacs, essentially killing all the little baby spiderlings. So she started wondering, you know, does the latitude and the temperature affect the number of wasps that lay their eggs in these egg sacs? So she put together an experiment. You know, as Bruce mentioned, we have the Dalton Highway here, which runs from Fairbanks all the way to Prudhoe Bay, the Arctic Ocean. So she set up, I think it's 6 different sites with these pitfall traps, with 30 pitfall traps. Every week we go out and collect these pitfall traps. So if you look at the middle picture, that's a typical pitfall trap that has ethanol in it. The organisms just fall in. And she's analyzing the number of spiders with egg sacs that she finds in these pitfall traps and the amount of wasps that are in them. So she's sort of asking the question, you know, as you move further north to the Arctic Ocean, are there more or less parasitoid wasps in these egg sacs? And if you look in the lower right-hand corner, this is the most exciting thing that we're doing, I think, personally. We captured live spiders, mother spiders, who all have egg sacs, and we are rearing them in the lab in hopes that they will emerge, little spiderlings will emerge, or that we will actually get to see one of these parasitoid wasps coming out of the egg sac. Because as up to this point, no one has actually ever seen the wasps emerging from the egg sac. And it's really hard to identify the species of the wasp by just looking at the larvae that's in the egg sac. So if we can actually get a living wasp, then we can identify the species of wasp that is parasitizing these egg sacs. So I think that's pretty much it for what I'm doing up here. Anything I've left out, I'm sure Amanda will be happy to chime in and tell you more about. This is a picture of the midnight sun here at Tulik. We get to see it every night. Pretty awesome. So thanks a lot. And if you have questions, now's the time, I guess.
Right. Thanks, Nell. That was really good. And there's been lots of conversation going on in the chat box, which Amanda has been attending to. At this point, I'll let you all kind of think through questions if you have them, and just raise your hand, which there's a little hand icon right above all the names of participants there on the list. And I just want to turn it over to Amanda and see if there's anything that you want to expand upon that you were talking about in the chat box. And then Nanette looks like she asked just another question. Why were wolf spiders chosen as opposed to other types of spiders? So I can turn that over to Amanda or to Nell, whichever is appropriate.
Hi, everyone. This is Amanda. We have some speakers on here, so I think that
all right.
The computer.
Looks
sorry
like
about
got
that.
A little bit of feedback.
But so I think the spiders up here because there are several different kinds of spiders, and in the moist acidic tundra, so there are a few different ecosystem types up here, but the moist acidic tundra is the dominant plant community type in this area. And in the moist acidic tundra, there are something like 16 different wolf spider species, and there are also these linacid spiders that have maybe 35 or 36 different species, and there are crab spiders and several other types. But in terms of biomass, in terms of the number and just amount of spiders that there are, the wolf spiders are by far the dominant predator. And Nell was talking a little bit about the just the amount of predator biomass that there is. And if you just do sort of a back of the envelope calculation, it seems like wolf spiders have just really a huge, huge amount of biomass compared to most of the other animal types up here, including the larger predators, the larger mammalian predators that we typically think of when we think about the tundra. So given that they seem like that they could have a really important role in the ecosystem, I wanted to focus on them. And also, interestingly, so wolf spiders occur in lots of different ecosystems. They're all over the world. But up here, it's kind of interesting because whereas in a forest, they probably feed on a lot of the animals in the leaf litter. Usually, in those types of ecosystems, you have more insects that are herbivorous. So, and you have a wider variety of animals that they could be feeding on. So wolf spiders are generalists, so they'll pretty much eat whatever comes across their path, and they will also eat dead animals as well, and other spiders. But up here, you have lower diversity, and a lot of the animal biomass is in the soil food web. So it's pretty interesting because they have a closer connection to the soil food web and to decomposition and nutrient cycling and these other processes that are connected to the carbon cycle that Bruce was mentioning. And so whereas some of the other spiders up here tend to feed on different types of prey.
Perfect, thanks. So it looks like Lucy has raised her hand. She's got a question. So Lucy, go ahead and press the talk button to speak and then press it again when you're done. We should be able to hear you.
So can you hear me? Well, hopefully you can. I'm wondering if we were seeing drastic change in the tundra as a result of climate change, what would the results of this study of the spiders show? Like, what would you expect your results to be if that was the case?
Hi, this is Amanda again. So one thing, so some of the work from the Arctic on spiders has shown that with warming, the spiders, you have a longer season in which the spiders can feed, and so the spiders become larger. And when the spiders become larger, they have larger egg sacs and so more eggs and more spiderlings, and so potentially their densities could increase. And so that's one of the projects that we're working on here. So we have a site south of Tulik and another site north of Tulik, and so we can look at how snowmelt and the length of the growing season impact how many spiders you have. And so if you have a longer time to feed, you would expect the spiders to be bigger, and we do see that in this area between the three sites. But interestingly, the densities of spiders are not any different. So one thing that we're doing with those isotopes is to see try and get an idea of where the spiders are in the food web in those different areas where you have bigger spiders that have higher reproductive rates but aren't increasing their densities. And one of our ideas is that these spiders are what's called density-dependent cannibals, and so the tundra can only support so many predators on a certain area. And so if there are too many and they're running into each other too often, they'll end up killing each other and either hunting each other or scavenging on each other. And so they might be regulating their densities despite getting larger. But so with our other experiment that Mel was talking about with those plots and the warming treatment, that's one thing that we're trying to figure out is if spider densities increase and things got warmer, what would happen with the soil community and decomposition rates.
Great, thanks. There were two questions that came through in the chat box as well. One was from Tanya, sorry if she missed this, but how do the spiders overwinter? And then Nanette was asking, do these same trends also occur in other arthropod communities, in the tundra particularly?
Okay, so the spider overwintering, we get that question all the time. And So the spiders have these antifreeze proteins, and so they don't actually freeze during the winter, but they probably go dormant. There's some speculation that some of their prey are active beneath the snow layer, this kind of insulated air layer, during the winter, but we don't really know. And that's actually something that we're trying to see if we can set up now to go through the winter and try and figure out some way to be sampling the spiders and the other arthropods underneath the snow layer. And it's a pretty complicated, it's just difficult because once you dig into the snow to pick up a sample, you can't put a sample there. So it takes a lot of planning beforehand, but we're going to try and see if we can set it up more to see like when the arthropods stop being active or if you still have a little bit of activity in that insulation layer underneath the snow. And in terms of other insects, so a lot of the work that's been done on the in the Arctic has been on the soil communities. There's a little bit of work on pollinators, and I think in terms of whole community work, it looks like, so there's some evidence that from places like Northeast Greenland, for example, that you're getting declining numbers of some of these soil arthropods, like these little springtails and mites that were in that picture that Mel showed you of some of the spider prey. But it seems like the declines in those types of animals almost has more to do with the moisture availability in the soil when the soil warms rather than the warmer temperatures themselves. There's also some evidence that herbivorous arthropods might be increasing as things warm, and that's partly potentially due to changes in plant communities that are associated with warming.
And one thing that I just wanted to add, one of the things that I've noticed here at Tulik is that everyone is really willing to help at all times. You can jump on any project. All the scientists are really open to having people come in their lab. And so anyway, one day last week, Amanda was trying to figure out with someone who overwinters here at Tulik how she can get this research about what the spiders do in the winter. And they probably had like a 45-minute conversation about, well, we could use styrofoam, and we could do this, and we could, you know, test it this day. And I mean, they just, it's amazing to me the amount of ideas that people have here and how willing everyone is to just pitch in and help. Bruce, do you want to add anything?
No, I agree. In fact, that's one of the things I've been doing here is, in addition to all that sampling I showed you with the pictures and lakes and rivers, going out with some of the other teams. I went out in the field with Amanda and Nell yesterday to see how they collect their spiders. I've been out with the insect teams to see what they're doing, studying insect communities in the tundra. So it's just a huge amount of science going on here and a great learning opportunity.
And I see in the question, it says, do the scientists communicate with each other, or is there work from Rose's work that overlaps with Amanda? The thing to understand is that a lot of this work, while it may not directly overlap, a lot of people here are really investigating the same thing. I mean, we're talking about climate change here, and we're talking about the role of carbon. You know, the tundra, like Bruce said, has this all of this stored carbon in the permafrost. So a lot of these experiments are really trying to figure out, where is this carbon going? What is it doing? What are the possible impacts on all different sorts of communities? Abiotic sectors, biotic sectors. We have people here who are just trying to figure out what plants are here and who all these different plants, you know, how do they photosynthesize? Do they photosynthesize at different rates? Do they photosynthesize at faster rates, you know, when it's dark out or when it's light out or, you know, if they're a certain height? Some people try and figure out all the different insects that are here and how do those insects, you know, affect a variety of sectors. So in the grand scheme of things, all of these projects in a way do kind of overlap and talk about the same thing, but just in very different ways. And they have all these little specific moving parts. So it's kind of neat to see all of these different projects and realize that, you know, they're all kind of working towards the same goal, which is making little pieces.
I just want to respond to Ken's question there too. It's starting, Ken, but We can talk about that offline.
Yeah, Ken's question of why isn't Bruce growing a beard? There are many pictures of Ken's expedition up on Denali growing some pretty wild beards up there. This is great. Thanks, you guys. I will open it up just in case there's any other questions as we kind of come to almost to a close here, or Bruce or Nell or anybody from the team want to wrap this up anymore, you're welcome to.
I want to say one more thing, Sarah. My wife Tanya is defending her master's thesis tomorrow, so I just want to wish her good luck on that.
Yay, good luck, Tanya.
Well, and you know, we did have a question here from Ken. Are you having fun? Is it fun up there at Tulik?
It's terrible. It's just so horrible. It's not fun at all. We actually just went to the Arctic Ocean yesterday and dipped our toes in, so we've definitely been enjoying our time here. Tulik is great. If you've read any of our journal entries, you have an idea of how great it is. The food is here is amazing. The people here are amazing. It's just a great place.
Yeah, we've been doing a lot of work in the field in the lab, but we've been also bike riding, hiking, taking tours up at Prudhoe Bay, going to the Arctic Ocean, and eating really, really good food here. Food is great.
And Bruce got to go on a helicopter ride. But
yeah, that was great, too.
I haven't gone yet.
Great. Thanks. Well, I want to thank everybody for participating up there at Tulik, and from all of you that are participating at home or at your schools, wherever you may be in the United States. Just like Bruce and Nell, they applied to be Polar Check teachers. There's opportunities for that in the future, and there are many different ways you can participate in Polar Check by following the expeditions, participating in these events, and joining our online list, and there's courses available. Oh, looks like Rose has one last question. Go ahead, Rose. Looks like she's typing. We'll see what comes. What do teachers here think is the best way for scientists like me to help get teachers and students engaged in the science? Great question, Rose. I will open that up to the teachers that are here on the event, and you can raise your hand if you want to add something verbally, or you can type in the chat box as well. It looks like a few people are typing, so I'll give you a minute. And while people are typing, I'll comment there on Nanette's comment about making these opportunities available during the school year. So we do have our Arctic field season, which is during the summer for our students that aren't in classes. So there are Polar Connect events during the summertime, but the archives are available. And Janet is commenting as well on the very same thing, mentioning that we have teachers going to Antarctica during our school year, during the winter, and there's an opportunity to take part in Polar Connect events from the poles as well, from Antarctica. Great question. It looks like people are logging off. So, Betsy's saying be available to answer student questions within reason, and that is also available through Bruce's and Nell's Ask the Team forum. So please go ahead and use those things throughout the school year, and thanks for asking that question, Rose. That was a good one. Thanks to everybody who was participating on the event, and the archive will be available shortly, so within the next week or so, we'll send out the links to folks. So again, thanks for participating and have a great rest of your day. Thanks, Nell, Bruce, and the team. You did great.